It's Philosophy Talk.
Oh, you son of a bird! I'm gonna tell your mama on you. She gonna whip you too. Yeah, that's what she gonna do. Come out at you.
In a free society, should any words be forbidden?
Some words are so hateful and so disrespectful, no decent person would ever use them.
Take the N-word. When you call someone by the N-word, you're really saying, look, you merit this treatment, and that's potentially violent treatment. But then go to a lesser slur, say, honky. The institution that supports that discrimination is just not as severe.
Said a bad word and don't you forget.
Where do slurs and curse words get their power?
That you're not really in the clear yet.
The greater significance is that they really reflect social facts.
Our guest is Chris Hom, author of Hating a Necessity, The Semantics of Racial Epithets.
Forbidden Words, coming up on Philosophy Talk. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the Bay at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. Ken and I are distinguished professors of philosophy there.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Now, today, we're going to talk about forbidden words.
Now, when we say forbidden, we don't mean legally forbidden. This is, after all, still the United Friggin' States of America. And last I looked, we still enjoy the First Amendment rights to say whatever we darn well please, except certain words on public radio. We're talking about morally forbidden words, words that hurt, insult, and demean.
But John, what do you make of that old saying? You know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words, well, they'll never hurt me. What about that?
Well, like most old sayings, it's wrong. I mean, think of racial epithets like the N-word, or ethnic slurs like the K-word, or gender-based slurs like the B-word or the C-word. That sort of language can be incredibly hurtful.
You know, I agree with you, but you know, there are some black people, for example, who use the N-word not as a term of derogation, but almost as a term of endearment or racial solidarity, although they pronounce it funny when they do that. But and there's this feminist magazine, Bitch. I doubt that the publishers of that magazine think of themselves as derogating women in any way.
Those are appropriated uses of slur words, Ken. That's when a group that was originally the target of a slur appropriates the word for their own use, and they use it in a non-slurring fashion.
You know, that appropriated use of slur words, I think they raise some really fascinating issues. I mean, take these black rappers. They use that word all the time. What actually, if anything, prevents a white person from using the N-word as a term of endearment? Or can only a black person get away with that, and why?
Well, we should definitely come back to those interesting questions, Ken, but let's focus on standard, non-appropriated uses of slur words first. My gut tells me it's always wrong to call a woman the B-word or to call a Jewish person the K-word.
Wrong. Wrong in what sense? Morally objectionable in the sense of wrong, or wrong in the sense of just false?
Both. To call a Jewish person the K-word is to imply that they're despicable because of their religion. To call a black person the N-word is to imply that they're despicable because of their race. But those things are just false. No one is despicable just because of their race or ethnicity or religion.
Well, but John, you know, not everything false is morally objectionable. I mean, I could call you a Martian. Sometimes I think you are a Martian. But I might have said something false when I did that, but not anything morally objectionable.
Well, when you use an ethnic slur, you're not just implying something false. You're helping perpetuate or echo a history of oppression. You're just helping yourself to certain negative attitudes that are associated with words, stereotypes that have been historically used to keep the targets of the slur in their place. That's the morally objectionable part. Conversely, if you refuse to use these words, you disavow the oppressive history that's wrapped up in them.
No, you know, but you make it, I take your point, but that way of thinking about it makes it sound as if slurs are always and only instruments of oppression. But, you know, take the slur word honky. That's a racial slur. That's a racial slur typically aimed at the historically more powerful by the historically less powerful. It's sort of a defensive slur.
I take your point, although I don't accept that you're less powerful than I am. In one way, though, honky is just as bad as the N-word. So I still find it objectionable.
Also, why do you find that objectionable?
Well, because it's used to denigrate white people just because they're white.
So now it sounds like you're suggesting that no slur words ever have legitimate uses. If that's what you're saying, I think I disagree. And here's why. Because it's just a fact. Some people are really and truly a-holes. Some people are really and truly effing Nazi bastards. And you know what? Such people deserve to be slurred.
Well, I think, as philosophers, we need to make a distinction. There are two different kinds of slurs, generalized slurs and particularized slurs. A generalized slur conveys the kind of thing we've been talking about, a negative attitude towards an entire class of people, even when the speaker is referring to just one member of that class. Particularized slurs, well, they're more particular, more individual.
So I guess you're saying if I call a Jewish person, say Schwartz, the K-word, I'm not just denigrating Schwartz, I'm denigrating all Jews in one fell swoop. But if I call Schwartz an a-hole, I'm just expressing a negative attitude toward him without necessarily having any bad attitudes toward anybody else.
Exactly right. Particularized slurs might sometimes be legitimate, but generalized slurs are probably never legitimate.
You know, John, I think you just made a great distinction. It's really cool, and I think it explains a lot. I think it shows how subtle and complicated the language of derogation can be. You know, it sounds like we've got a lot to discuss here. I'm really eager to dig deeper into this.
Well, first we're going to go to our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch. We sent her to take a closer look at that phenomenon we mentioned a while back of appropriated slur words. She files this report.
Many years ago, Inga Muzio was working as a writer for an alt-weekly newspaper in Seattle. At the top of every article, she'd write word count, followed by the number of words. One day, she submitted a story and accidentally omitted the letter O in count and got an entirely different word. The newsroom was in a tizzy. Here's Muzio on the phone from Seattle.
That got me to just being fascinated with just the naked power of this word, you know? The responses it evokes in people is fascinating.
Muzio decided to write a book about the origins of the word and her quest to reclaim it.
Now, notice that the C word ought to be exactly parallel semantically to prick.
Robin Lakoff teaches linguistics at UC Berkeley. She says that word is one of the most vulgar in the English language.
Of course, we remember that not all that long ago you were able to say penis on radio and television. But you couldn't say what Oprah likes to call the vajayjay.
But why name your book after a slur directed toward women? Lakoff says if done right, taking pejoratives and spinning new meanings for them is an effective way to take the sting out. For example, the word black was used as an insult for a few hundred years until the civil rights movement reclaimed it.
This was tremendously controversial at the time. Even among white liberals, even among some blacks, it was uncomfortable because it still carried those negative connotations.
There's kind of an art to reappropriating words, like queer. The word was taken by LGBT activists and repackaged as an umbrella term for sexual minorities. The reclaiming of queer was a source of inspiration for Andy Zeisler, the editor and co-founder of Bitch magazine. Bitch bills itself as a feminist critique of pop culture. Here's Zeisler on the phone from Portland.
We knew what feminists are often called, and we just said, well, we're just going to go ahead and call ourselves that before you have a chance to.
When directed toward women, linguist Robin Lakoff says bitch takes on the meaning that a woman is out of the control of men. That almost makes the word sound like a compliment, but we all know it's usually used as an insult.
The bitchiest thing you can do is take back bitch. Because it says you can't control me, you can't control my language, you can't make implications about who I am and what I'm not and what I ought to be by throwing these words at me. So if you can do it, if you can do it right, in the right attitude and so on, it's a very powerful thing.
I'm a bitch, I'm a lover, I'm a child, I'm a mother.
But that doesn't mean the title of the magazine doesn't offend some of the very people it's fighting for. Andy Zeisler says they've gotten many angry phone calls, like from mothers whose children came face-to-face with bitch in line at the grocery store.
The ones that are most interesting to me are from people who say, you know, I really support the magazine, but I'll be honest, I have to rip the cover off whenever it arrives because I just don't like being confronted with that word.
Zeisler says the process of reclaiming a slur is a lengthy one, and she doesn't think the word bitch is quite there yet.
You know, there's always going to be the need for a word that's used to try and put those women in their place. And, you know, up till now, it's really been bitch. It's sort of been the go-to word. I don't know if that's really going to change.
Still, Zeisler does believe that bitch has been defanged slightly over the years. It's not quite as offensive as it was in the mid-90s. And she hopes that bitch will follow in the path of queer. Though in the end, linguist Robin Lakoff says it isn't really about words at all.
They're just reminders about the position that women are in and how important it is to get out of that position if we can.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, and thanks to Robin Lakoff and Caitlin's other guests for that quick tour of appropriated slurs. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
We're joined now by Chris Hom. Chris is a professor of philosophy from Texas Tech University. He's recently been a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center, so he's got Stanford street cred here, where he's been working on a book with a working title, Hating and Necessity, The Semantics of Racial Epithets. Chris, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So Chris, slur words have become a hot topic in philosophy. Your work is responsible for this to a large extent. But that raises the question, how did you get interested in slur words?
It's funny, I was watching television at home, and I was watching MTV, and there's a show on MTV called Pimp My Ride, and it's about getting your jalopy fixed up really fancy. And
Pimp My Ride.
My Ride.
Somehow I missed that.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, is it okay to name a television show that? Isn't this really disrespectful towards women? And what does this word mean? And how does it function as the title of a television show? And so, you know, as a trained philosopher, I went to the literature and wanted to see what people were writing about this, and there really wasn't that much out there. And so it just, you know, I started to, well, you know, look, I'm a trained philosopher, so I should try to figure out what's going on.
Well, now, in the opening, we said that you're doing two different things when you utter a slur. But one thing you're doing is you're directly saying or implying something false. And two, you're helping to perpetuate negative attitudes and stereotypes that are typically tied to a history of oppression and exclusion. So did we get it right? You agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think that's right. I think that you know, particularly racial slurs, I mean slurs in general, they're a deeply failed language.
Deeply failed language, but they're highly effective. How can a deeply failed language be so highly effective at causing hurt and pain and all that sort of stuff?
Well, I think it's failed in that what it does is it reflects the institutions that support them. And what you're doing when you're calling someone a slur is that you're really prescribing that ideology to that person. You're saying, you merit this treatment. You deserve to be treated this way because of your race, gender.
Okay, but let's take a really tricky one. Well, I don't know if it's tricky or not. What I called in the opening a defensive slur. So an oppressed minority wants to give the finger, as it were, to the oppressor.
Sure.
And it comes
sure.
up with a slur for the oppressor.
Yeah.
It says
yeah.
hunky, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
What do you think of that? Does your theory fit that kind of approach?
Well, my theory relies on a kind of reflective relationship between the meaning of a slur and the institution that supports it. So you have to look at the different institutions that support various slurs. So take the N-word. Think about the institution of racism towards blacks, very severe. You know, it started with slavery, went through Jim Crow South, and you know, exists to this day, though perhaps in more subtle ways. And so when you call someone by the N-word, you're really saying, look, you merit this treatment, and that's, you know, that's really bad, right? It's really negative, potentially violent treatment. But then go to a lesser slur, say honky. The institution that supports that discrimination is just not as severe. It's
no,
not as
wait a
powerful.
Minute. It's the same institution, except that one supports the oppressor slurring the oppressed, and one supports the oppressed slurring back the oppressor. It's the very same institution that supports both. It's just our place in the institution. But you know what? This is complicated stuff, and I'll give you a chance to tell me why I'm wrong in a little bit.
Okay.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. Our guest is Chris Hom from Texas Tech University. We're talking about forbidden words.
Words may lack the brute physical power of sticks and stones, unless you can yell really loud, but they pack a much greater emotional punch. Where does all that power to denigrate and demean come from? We're going to talk about that after the break.
How words hurt, plus questions from our audience, that's you, when Philosophy Talk continues.
In its place.
Thanks to our musical guest, the Playtone. That was an umming good performance. This is Philosophy Talk. I am John Perry.
And I, Ken Taylor. We're discussing forbidden words with Chris Holm from Texas Tech University.
Where exactly does the power of words to hurt and demean come from? Can slur words ever be legitimately used? Or are all slurs always morally inappropriate? We'd like to know what you think. Just step up to the microphone and join the discussion.
So, Chris, I want to come back to that N-word, honky, asymmetry in a little bit. But first, I want to perform a little thought experiment because I want to see the extent to which slur words actually do harm to the people they're aimed at. Mm-hmm. So here's a thought experiment. Imagine two racists. They've got more or less identical attitudes toward whatever, their racial victims. They behave in the same way. They vote in the same way. Let's say they're black people that are the targets. Now, suppose that there's this difference between them. One habitually uses racial slurs to refer to their target, and the other
to attempt to refer.
Yeah, to attempt to refer to those people, and one never does, right? So we've got the loquacious racist has clearly done something offensive, but has he done something harmful, something above and beyond whatever harm the silent racist has done? What do you think about that?
I think it depends on the institution that the slur mirrors. So if this institution of racism that we're talking about is something like our institution, that may involve practices like lynching. These are really threatening, dangerous practices that are conventionally associated with the ideology of racism. And if that's the case, then I don't know how harmful it is, but it's certainly going to be threatening.
Well, okay, but wait a minute. So suppose the silent racist, I don't mean that he's silent or she's silent, just never uses racial slurs. Suppose that they always refer to black people as black people. Mm-hmm. But whenever they refer to black people as black people, I don't know, maybe they do it with an attitude of derision. They endorse whatever practices the other person. I'm just trying to figure out what is the singular harm that the speech does above and beyond the attitude and expressing the, you know what I mean? So these slur words are kind of conventional means of expressing certain attitudes, but I could have those attitudes and express them in different ways.
Right. I think it's more than a reflection of the internal attitude of the speaker. I think it's a prescription to the target that says, you merit that treatment. You deserve to be treated that way because of your group affiliation.
If I believe and keep to myself that all black people deserve whatever treatment X, right? But if I say all N-word people ought to blah, 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 is a kind of invitation to the world to treat my targets in a certain way?
I think that's a fair way to put it.
You look like you.
Well, I mean, suppose we got a word, I'll think of something non-contemporary like Whig.
Quig.
Used to be a political party, Whig.
Whig, okay.
W-H-I-G.
W-H-I-G, Whigs, right. And suppose we're back in that era, the mid-1800s. There is no institutionalized practice of using Whig to mean that people are despicable just because of their political party. But I myself believe that. Mm-hmm. I believe that Whigism is a trait shared all and only by Whigs. And so when I say, you're a Whig, all the attitudes that I might be able to tap into with a conventionalized slur word, I have without needing the word to tie into them. Is that a basically different situation than if I call someone with the K word or the N word that has an institutional basis behind it, if my attitudes are the same?
I think it is a different situation. I don't think that individual speakers have that power to amplify the derogatory force of a term. I think that power really comes from the social institutions, the social facts.
Wait a minute, let's challenge you there. You say you don't think an individual speaker has the power to amplify, but any word can be turned into a slur word with just the right intonation. But I mean, I can use it in a slurring fashion. Mm-hmm. I can say, "You philosophers," you know?
Yeah.
And that implies philosophers are idiots, and I think philosophers are idiots.
But maybe the intonation is the thing you're tapping into.
Well, but there's a generalized thing in language. By intoning a word in a certain way, you can turn its use into a slurring use, and I can just do that. So I'm not quite sure what you mean.
I think it's a creation of an insult. I think that's right. I think this tone, this sort of up-down tone, is a conventional way of turning, you know, the pronunciation of any word into the expression of your negative attitudes. I think that's different, though, than what's going on with the other cases.
Well, to explain the difference.
I think the other cases are really a prescription that says you deserve what the institution.
But suppose that I start out, to take Nazi Germany. I suppose, I never was there, but I suppose that probably every Nazi, whenever they said the word Jew, they said it with a sneering intonation, right? Mm-hmm. And that among that certain group, it became a term of derision. Yeah. I suppose that their victims never gave up ownership of the term Jew, but they never said it with a tone of self-ownership.
Yeah.
I mean, help me understand that dynamic.
That sounds almost like reverse appropriation, right? You take a perfectly reasonable word that people apply to themselves and others apply to them with just a descriptive thing, and you turn it into a slur word.
So how would you analyze that?
Well, I think Jew is tricky, and I think precisely for the reasons that Ken raised. Compare Jewish as an adjective phrase and Jew as an adjective phrase. So Alan is the director of a Jewish museum. Perfectly fine. Alan is the director of a Jew museum.
Hmm.
Ooh. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like something a Nazi would say.
Yeah. And I think that's tap. And this is a striking difference.
So there's this complicated social dynamic over these words. And, you know, this is a social enterprise, this Philosophy Talk. And we've got lots of questions from our live audience. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about forbidden words at the Mars Theater in Berkeley. And we've got a questioner. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and your question and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Delicia Kamens, and I'm from San Francisco. And I'm wondering how much of the burden should be on the hearer or the listener. For example, being from San Francisco, I have to deal with the fruh word all the time, which I find incredibly offensive, but only if you're from San Francisco or the Bay Area.
The which word?
The fruh word. I just can't say it. It's
Frisco.
Frisco.
Is that offensive?
Oh, God.
To even hear it, sorry. And when you're in England, the word bug and bugger are offensive, but not here. And when you're in England, the word fag means cigarette, but when you're here, you have to choose not to be, or you can choose to be offended by it. But when you're in England and you hear that word, you choose not to be.
Chris, you got a view about that?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think there's a distinction that needs to be made here, maybe between what's offensive and what is biased or derogatory. I think what's offensive can vary with different people. I think people have different thresholds of tolerance, people have different social backgrounds, people have different personal histories, and I think all of that goes into what people find offensive. I think there's something, though, that's a little bit less subjective, and it's what I call the derogatory potential of a word. And that, I think, is grounded in objective social facts.
So wait a minute, derogatory potential of a word. So different words have different derogatory potential?
Right.
Illustrate that idea.
I'm
not quite sure I get it.
Yeah, so I think that these words are responsive to different institutions. So we talked about maybe the institution that supplies the derogatory force for the N-word. Compare that with the institution towards discrimination of English people, British people.
Is there such an institution?
Well, they don't cook well. They have bad teeth, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right. It's difficult to sort of put your finger on it.
So when
you use the word limey as a slur towards English people, that's what you're tapping into, and that's just why it's not that bad a word.
Right. So you think some slurs have more force, some more intrinsic force than others?
That's right, intrinsic. Yeah.
No, is that you think
as part of its
you
literal
think
meaning.
You think it's, oh, that's what I want to get at. You think it's part of the meaning.
That's right.
Now suppose, I want to challenge you on that one.
Because
suppose that the power relations between blacks and whites were shifted and that we replicated the history of racial struggle in America I mean, subsequent to the Civil Rights Movement, you know, the blacks became predominant and all that sort of, and we replicated the history of race in America in reverse, right? So that hunky now became the oppressor's word, and the N-word now became the oppressed word.
Yeah.
Would those words ipso facto change their meaning? It doesn't seem to me. They have the same meaning, right? But the power relations are different. I mean, so you seem to be building into the meaning of the slur word the power relations that go with it. I don't know why you should believe that.
Well, I think that many philosophers of language and linguists, and I think including us on stage, think that the meaning is something situated in a speech community. It's not something directly reflective of the individual's mind.
But let's make a distinction that the three of us know. It may not be familiar to our audience, but it's a very good and important distinction between illocution and perlocution. What I literally say and what I do in saying it. Mm-hmm. So if in an institutional background in which one race has power over another in discriminatory practices, you know, with respect to that the less powerful, then an utterance of a slur directed at that can have serious, what Grice called, perlocutionary effects, because it's a kind of threat. I denigrate you and I thereby threaten you. I threaten you with the whole weight of these institutions behind you. Mm-hmm. Right? It seems to me you need a distinction like that, and you're not making a distinction like that. Well, so the power is the kind of, the sort of threatening power of the word is contingent on social arrangements,
Let me suggest another way to handle it, though. I mean, because when you say, does it have the same meaning or different meaning in these two different situations, right? Honky in the real world, honky in the blacks' dominant world. Depends on how you describe the meaning. If you describe the meaning in terms of the actual social institution, then Chris is committed to saying it has a different meaning. But if you just have a variable in there and say its meaning is that the social institution whose usage it reflects, blah, 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 then you could say it has the same meaning, but the parameters of meaning have changed dramatically. Sorry if I'm getting a little inside baseball.
Well, that's what's called contextualism. Right? Yes. There's a kind of, in a different context, it can mean something different because you kind of set parameters differently.
That's calling me a contextualist?
Yeah, but with a purr, not a growl. What do you think about that?
I think we've also got to keep clear, in your example, there's the N-word in our English, and then there's the N-word of English spoken in that world. And I think we want to keep those two separate.
Let's get some more questioners in here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Crystal Lee. I'm from Los Angeles. I think it's one thing to talk about how forbidden words are harmful, but it's another to decide whether or not should be legislated. Do you think that the First Amendment should protect hate speech?
Well, so the latest ruling from the Supreme Court is really Brandenburg versus Ohio in 1969. And that standard is really that, you know, if the usage of a word is likely to bring about an imminent threat, then it's not protected under First Amendment speech. Most people have held that racial slurs fail that test. I think it's more difficult. So on my view, since individual slurs are sensitive to the institutions that support them, that fuel them, if that institution is violent enough and threatening enough, then I think that some of these slurs, particularly the N-word, you know, they might merit legitimate intrinsic threats, and threats are not protected under the First Amendment. So I think you really have to look at it on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, they used to have this phrase called fighting words. And these aren't always fighting words, but they can be fighting words. But I want to make one important point, which is the First Amendment protects you from the government, the U.S. government, and then the states through the 14th Amendment, from prohibiting you from doing certain things and perhaps prohibiting you from using slurs in a wide variety of situations. But that doesn't mean that a private institution like Stanford University or a business like Google can't prohibit its employees or its students in using these words in certain situations because that's not a government entity. I say that because I was part of a committee that set up such a ban at Stanford, which then a chicken-hearted president undid.
But I want to suggest, suppose the First Amendment did allow the forbidding of these words, it would be pointless in one way, because again, you can turn any word into a slur word just by the tone of your voice. And now is the Supreme Court going to say, well, you should never have a slurring tone? And suppose that a group of people decided always to use philosophers with a tone of disgust.
Well, it would take, they'd have to have a lot of power to get...
Well, some people do have
power. Well, not enough power to get a whole institution of rape and lynching and forced slavery associated with it.
Let's get some more questions here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Maya Steinhardt. I'm from Sacramento. And I was wondering if it is possible to teach children from a young age that forbidden words used to be used by the oppressors, but now they are being used by the oppressed to show we are no longer oppressed?
That's an excellent question. That has to do with this appropriated use. My son asked me, we were talking about this show, and I said, and I asked, he asked me how I felt about black people using the N-word. I said, I feel really uncomfortable. He said, I think it's cool. It only bothers me when white people use the N-word, because by us using it, he said, we make it our own word. And he thinks that's a very powerful thing. What do you think?
Well, I was just going to point out, because I want to get Chris's view on it, there's this recent incident with Gwyneth Paltrow. She has a lot of black friends, a lot of rap musician friends, and she borrowed a phrase from some piece of rap music that had the N-word in it. And boy, she got slammed. What do you think of that?
Yeah,
both of these things, both her question and John's question.
Yeah, I think that, on my view, appropriation is really the creation of a counter-institution. So it's the creation of another social force that's trying to compete with the oppressor. And so you're really trying to alter the meaning of this word. You're trying to compete with the other external facts. And in that way, I think you can make the word have a different political purpose. You can make it a term of endearment, a term of affiliation.
But if that's your motive, then you shouldn't be bothered by Gwyneth using it, because she's helping you develop that institution.
The appropriated N-word is complicated.
I
think it's complicated because African-American leaders have decidedly reserved use of the appropriated N-word for in-group members only.
Well, African-American leaders. I don't know if I'm an African-American leader. I hate that use of the N-word.
You're not alone.
I wouldn't speak in generalities about that. I think that's a very broad thing. But, you know, there's lots to dig in here, and we'll take it up more after a short break.
Great.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the power of forbidden words with Chris Holm from Texas Tech University, who's author of the forthcoming Hating a Necessity, The Semantics of Racial Epithets.
Suppose that tomorrow we could simply outlaw all words that derogate, insult, or demean. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing? Are all forms of derogation and insult inappropriate? How do we distinguish acceptable slurs from unacceptable ones?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll keep this conversation going and take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Maws out, paws out, let's talk rude. People bury bum drawers. Dance in the garden in the nude. People bury bum drawers. Let's write rude words all down our street. Stick out our tongues at the people we meet. Let's have an intellectual treat. People belly bum, belly belly bum bum. People belly belly bum bum. People belly bum.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about forbidden words with Chris Holm from Texas Tech University.
Chris, I want to go back to something Ken and I touched on earlier. I think no Jew ever deserves to be called the K word. No woman ever deserves to be called the C word. But as Ken pointed out, some people really are effing Nazi bastards. And some people are utter a-holes. What's the difference between slurs like a-hole that are sometimes appropriate and words like the C-word or the N-word that are never appropriate?
I think that's a great question. I guess with the a-hole example, I think that's a case of metaphor. I think it's a case of metonymy.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's a little bit like limey, that there's really, you know, no institution of bias associated with it. And so I think it just doesn't have that much force.
Well, wait a minute, it may not have that much force, and it may have started out as a metaphor, but if it's a metaphor, it's a dead metaphor, which makes it close to literal, right?
Sure.
And I think there's just a meaning, a slurring meaning of a-hole, and that some people... So John said two things in the beginning. He said, you know, you are an N-word is always false, right? Because it implies this thing that's necessarily false.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this endorsing these negative attitudes. It seems to me it's just true and appropriate, morally appropriate to call an a-hole an a-hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
And moreover, it seems to me that language makes available this kind of use of
itself. But with the N-word or the K-word, there's this background group. So you're saying you're despicable because you're a member of this background group. But what's the background group with the metaphorized a-hole?
I don't think there is a background group. Yeah. And that's why you made a nice distinction. It's particularized rather than generalized. There's no particular group of people. You're saying they're despicable in virtue of that. It's kind of getting closer to a descriptive use.
Yeah.
Because there are certain characteristics that you can have that make you... Your wife says to you, stop being an a-hole. Well, you can really be being an a-hole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but it seems like your view doesn't allow that kind
of stuff. Well, I think that the class of racial slurs is really just a subset of a class of insults in general. So I think that there are many uses of language that can be insulting. And my theory is not designed to explain all of those. So I think that's one thing. So
a-hole's not a slur, it's just an insult.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Let's see what our live audience thinks. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. I'm Indigo Moore from Sacramento. I want you three to discuss the importance of reappropriating a word. Now, obviously, say with the N-word, you're going to have certain opinions about it. But how about a word like communist and how it became an insult after the McCarthy era?
Well, the appropriation and reappropriation of words with these slurring functions is really complicated, right? I mean, there is now queer studies in universities. No, queer studies has no derogatory force at all. But when I was growing up, that was something you didn't call a person unless you wanted to get in a fight. So that word has been completely appropriated, completely. Maybe the N-word is on its way to becoming that, although I'm kind of interested
in the process that goes the other way, though, that he alluded to. Take liberal, socialist.
Oh, that's true.
Now, you know, you go throughout the English-speaking world, these are not slurs. It's perfect. And in historically in the United States, it wasn't a slur to be either a liberal or a socialist. But now, you know, they insult Obama when they call him a socialist. You wouldn't insult him if they said it in Europe or in England.
Right.
And liberal, I think they probably failed with that word, but they succeeded long enough to frighten Dukakis out of using it.
Well, they succeeded long enough so that people who once called themselves liberals found another word, progressives, which they haven't yet succeeded in, right? But now liberal in many parts of this country. I remember George Bush during the Bush-Dukakis election saying about Michael Dukakis, he's a card-carrying member of the ACLU, right? Like, he wanted to turn ACLU into a slur word. Do you have a thought about
this? Is there a name for this opposite to appropriation?
I want to make a distinction again here between the slurs and the insults. So I think there are conventionalized ways of turning words into insults, like philosopher, right? bowler. If you have that kind of right up down intonation, you can basically turn any word into an insult. I think this other issue of how slurs sort of start to gain power. I go back to that mirroring relation. So as institutions of discrimination become more systematic, for example, towards Latinos in the United States, I think you're going to have slurs for that group then also increase in power. And I think this is an example of words that are starting to take off in terms of their derogatory capabilities.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello. My name's Brian. I'm from Riverside, California. What happens when... let's say we retire a certain word that we consider offensive. Isn't there another word in waiting? Aren't there always going to be those sentiments that are going to be there that are somehow going to be reflected in our language? Like the word heck or darn, right? We can take out those other words and replace them, but we all know what we mean when we say them. So I'm wondering if it's ever truly possible to do away with those kinds of words and really truly get rid of them, because we all know what people mean when they say those things.
I think that's a great question. On my view, I hope so, because I think that means that the institution of bias and injustice has been, you know, has diminished. So here's one good example. The word hunk used to be a derogatory term for a Hungarian day laborer. And, you know, as Hungarians have integrated into American culture, now that word no longer is derogatory, and it just means, you know, physically attractive male. It would be nice, right, if slurs like the N-word faded away that way.
But generally, the replacement can be, I would think, a good thing. I mean, take Gen Xer, right? That suggests that, you're a bad person because you're part of this despicable generation. And, but maybe it's an age thing. Maybe not everybody uses it that way.
No, I don't think everybody does use it that way.
We've just revealed John's ageism now.
If you replace that with something more particular and specific, like you say, oh, you're just a young person that suffers from a surplus of self-esteem, that's more accurate, right? So it's an improvement.
Let's get some questions from our live and lively audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. My name's Alexia. I'm also from Riverside, California. And I have a... Since words are the vehicle of thought, are you concerned with limiting thought by limiting language?
Well, that's an interesting question, Chris.
I
don't know if you want to ban all these unappropriated uses of
some
these little words.
Some kind of fascist streak you coming seem to out think, here? Yeah.
I think that's a great question. I think what I would want to point to is the kind of external dimension to the meanings that I want to postulate. So I think that there's a way in which what's inside the head of any particular speaker need not match up with what's on the outside, with the ideology of you can access that negative ideology without having every detail, without subscribing to every bit of it. So in a way, I mean, you know, to get back to Gwyneth Paltrow, I mean, I think that, you know, even if she's, you know, pure of heart, she can still access the negative power of these words simply in virtue of being externally situated in just the right way. So I think that the externalism, it allows us to say things more powerfully than what is even in our hearts. And I think that's what makes these words extremely dangerous.
Wait, but there's a couple of things. See, I got to sort through what you're saying.
Sure.
Can access the power of these things even if that's not what's in your heart. You shouldn't... To say the N-word at a person, not in this kind of quoting use that we're kind of tiptoeing around, but if to say the N-word at a person, it implies that you endorse the attitudes and all that stuff that associate. And indeed, it's like a sincerity condition on the use of the N-word. You shouldn't use these words unless you have in your heart these negative things. We're bracketing the appropriation by the out-group.
Sure. Right.
I don't quite understand.
I think that's the common presumption.
Yeah.
I don't think that needs to be there, though. I think there can be uses which explicitly reject the ideology. So if I say something like, institutions that treat blacks as ends are morally corrupt, I think that's a use that disavows the speaker from the ideology. I agree it's difficult.
It's really difficult.
In the non-appropriate cases, it's very
difficult. It's really difficult.
But I think it can be done.
Suppose you were a racist. Well, let's not use the racial thing, just because I want to say the word. Suppose you really didn't like Jones, and you said, that damn Jones just got tenure, and I wanted to tell John what you said.
Yeah.
I say, John, you know what Chris just said? He just told me that damn Jones got tenure. You know what? Even though I'm trying to report on what you said, I actually damn Jones myself, right? Even though I was just trying to report the content. So these words are so loaded. If I use it in a lot of circumstances, I can't divorce the content from myself, so I have to tell John, Chris just told me Jones got tenure. And maybe he thought, but I can't say the damned of her without...
I think the data there is really subtle.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thanks. I'm David. I'm from Batavia, Illinois. And I was wondering if, since we're on public radio, if you feel that censorship kind of can add some weight and force to these words that otherwise wouldn't stay around as long or have the type of force they do. And
well, I think you're asking a really important kind of question. So in some ways, by not allowing ourselves to say the words but only to describe them or put them in scare quotes, in some ways we are acknowledging their power. We're kind of paying homage to their power. On the other hand, if we were to say them over and over again, we'd become desensitized to them and we'd diminish, we would, like, they would lose their power, at least in this circle, right? When we were talking about doing this show, we were trying to decide whether we're going to use them or only describe them, and it's a complicated thing, because if you, in this little group, make them lose their power by repeating them over and over again, you don't change the outside world, right? So I think it's a really complicated thing. Do you bow to their power or do you try to diminish their power?
Well, it's really hard to do, because I have an Afro-American friend who told me he really couldn't enjoy reading Huckleberry Finn, even though he realized it was a great novel, because just that N-word. Now, here's the N-word used by an author reporting the dialect that's long dead and wasn't really. And yet, just looking at the word made him uncomfortable. So I tend to be in favor of these restrictions. I don't think kids in the ghetto should turn on their radio and have to hear that word.
You have a view about that?
Yeah, I just want to echo what you said, and I think also what Robin Lakoff said at the end of the Roving Reporter segment. I think these words are hurtful, they're offensive, and to that extent, you know, perhaps we should think about not using them and not allowing people to use them. But I think the greater significance is, you know, on my view, that they really reflect social facts. And until those social facts change, you can get other words that then tap into those institutions as well. And so, you know, what's more important, I think, is the real social change, right? The sort of injustices that need correcting.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
So I'm Daniel from Sacramento, and the question I actually had was about the popularized use of words like sports teams, the Redskins. How is that, I mean, why is that okay? How does that continue to exist when it's a powerful word?
Well, you know the answer. Capitalism. Is it morally okay?
You didn't tone correctly when you said that.
Is it morally okay? But well, does it perpetuate stereotypes and all that have played? Well, yes, it does. But there is this almighty dollar thing.
Well, Stanford used to be called the Indians, and our, in my mind, sainted President Richard Lyman, who's gone on to his greater reward, did away with that in one fell stroke way back in 1969 or so. And what a great thing that was for Stanford not to suffer through all the agonies that some sports teams are going through today, well, to get rid of this obviously objectionable but lucrative practice.
That's certainly true. I agree with you. But the solution they came up with was to name the sports teams after a color, the Cardinal. That's really stupid.
The students wanted to call it the robber barons, but the administration wouldn't go along with it.
Do you want to comment on this?
Well, Texas Tech's football team is the Red Raiders, so you can read into that what you will.
So, you know, this has been a fascinating conversation, Chris. I fear that we've just scratched the surface, so maybe we'll have to do a follow-up. But for now, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been Chris Holm. He's a professor of philosophy from Texas Tech University. He's been a fellow this year at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's author of the forthcoming book, Hating and Necessity. This conversation will continue on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow us on our very active Facebook page, and you can follow our tweets on Twitter.
And each week, you can get a free podcast of Philosophy Talk. You just go sign up at our website, philosophytalk.org. And now, we leave the unspeakable truth to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, you've been talking about forbidden words. I have a list of words and phrases that may not be forbidden, but in my perfect world, would be. Let me holler at you, G, bro, my peeps, and see if you say snap. A Sammy is not a sandwich. Bloobs are not blueberries. A resi is not a reservation. Avoid veggie, foodie, positivity, yummy, vacay, hoodie, homie, boobies, munchie, sippy cup, eatery, and mommy. Don't hate the playa. Want to hang out? Want to hit up the mall? That's so fun. Does your footprint have sustainability? What we're talking about here is action items in the toolbox at the end of the day that can leverage benchmarks into a value-added app position to play cross-platform hardball. Seriously. Literally. Indeed. Going forward, America needs to have that conversation. By monetizing real-time deliverables, the tipping point can gain traction in the helicopter view that will grow the economy. It's a seamless, world-class turnkey solution. Core competency is the new normal. For stakeholders, that's the takeaway if there's no walk back. But embroiled repercussions in oil-rich nations might derail talks, according to rebuffed senior officials, factoring in the margin of error. Buy into the result-driven best practice for compelling deliverables. Is there somewhere a dessert that is not decadent? Is there an interior that is not cozy? Is there a journey that isn't amazing? A struggle that isn't heroic? A fruit that is not low-hanging? Is there a senator who is not contrite? Touch base with the long tail for impactful long pole items. Church, hand to God, word, indeed. Excellent, amazing. Drool-worthy bromance, chiclet, adorbs, amazeballs, oh noes, I don't have skin in the game. Just saying, stop saying, just saying. That's so random, for the win, not gonna lie, the best perfect storm ever, indeed. Basically, we need to touch base, rise above politics, and rock the austerity measure. Jealous much? How meta is that? No brainer, duh. Are we drinking the Kool-Aid or eating our own dog food? Whatevs, absolutely, totes, take that offline. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Joshua Raul Brody, a.k.a. The Playtones.
Our producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Special thanks go to Eric Blugzeski, Stephanie Wiseman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Tyler Haddow, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, and Corey Goldman.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.